Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Got a good one lined up for you today. Colleen Rowley's going to be here. As you know, she was a lawyer at the Minneapolis FBI office, and her team could have prevented the 9/11 attack if they'd been allowed to do their job by their bosses. She was Time Magazine Person of the Year in, I guess it should have been 2002, but I read somewhere 2003, so I don't know. But anyway, she's the great whistleblower from the 9/11 era there, Colleen Rowley, now a civil rights activist, well, civil liberties activist. It's funny, the lingo there. Anyway. Like Ray McGovern, who we talked to on the show yesterday, she's just back from Moscow where she's been hanging out with Edward Snowden. So, I didn't actually get a chance to really hear as much from Ray yesterday as I wanted to about Ed Snowden. Not to get all gossipy or whatever. Trevor Tim's going to be on the show tomorrow, just like Rachel Levinson something was on the show yesterday about the NSA details, the substance. I'll do my very best to cover the substance for you here. I've had Bruce Schneier on and all these guys. Anyway, but I do want to know a little bit about Snowden. How's he hanging in there? This guy's an American hero after all. Barack Stalin has exiled him to Siberia. Boy, that was hard for me to come up with right there. Did you hear that? Almost popped the neuron. Anyway. So the good news is that I turned off the audio on my phone so that you won't hear all my text messages coming in. And that also, actually, he's not in Siberia. He's in the suburbs of Moscow. Not doing too bad anyway. So we're going to catch up with Colleen Rowley, who went and gave him the Sam Adams Award for being a heroic whistleblower. And, you know, it's funny, and I'll probably be redundant and repeat this later in the show when I'm interviewing the lady, but it's funny to me when I read somewhere, oh, I know what it was, Colleen Rowley tweeted out a local Fox News affiliate story about her from, I'm not sure if it's from her hometown or from somewhere, about it. And they were saying, oh yeah, you know, Edward Snowden, some say he's a heroic whistleblower and others say he's a traitor. Well, you know, here's the thing about that. It seems to me self-evidently true that if some say he's a whistleblower, then he's a whistleblower. And the people who say he's a traitor, well, they're just tools of the state. You know, I never understood that line in the 1980s when it was the pop song about some of them like to be abused, but now I get it. But nobody disagrees that maybe Benedict Arnold was a whistleblower. No, he was a traitor. That's pretty easy. What Edward Snowden did, if you don't like it, tough, but it ain't treachery. Maybe he blew a whistle that you wish he hadn't blown. Maybe he saw something corrupt in something that you can only bow down and worship, and you disagree with his assessment of the corruption in that which you worship. You know, the U.S. national security state. And still, he's a whistleblower. Doesn't change the fact that he's a whistleblower. Just because you don't like the whistle that he blew. If he was a traitor, he would have handed all this stuff over to a foreign government to use to exploit. That would sort of be, you know, the definition of the term and all that. But Glenn Greenwald is not a foreign government. Glenn Greenwald is a journalist. And thankfully, he's actually mostly a columnist. He has broken a few stories in the past, including the abuse, some, including me, would say torture, of Bradley Manning in his cell at Quantico, Virginia. After he was finally brought to the country from his animal pen in Kuwait. Her, Chelsea, whatever, sorry. Anyway. Glenn Greenwald broke that story about the abuse of Manning at Quantico. So that's some original journalism. That's the only one I'm thinking of right off the top of my head. But he's written some great books that, you know, have a lot of original research in them and that kind of thing. Anyway. But he's a civil liberties activist, writer, and the perfect choice. If this guy Snowden had sent some encrypted text message to me saying, who should I give the documents to? I would have said Greenwald. That guy will not let you down. He will get the work done. Promise. So, anyway, Snowden didn't call me because he figured out that same thing for himself. There's no treachery there. The only people who call that treachery are just government employees who, of course, it's in their interest to deliberately confuse the country and the state, the government, with the land and the people who live here, suffering under its tyranny, mostly. Oh, we are the people. Isn't that funny? We the people. Sometimes, you know, regular civilians get it all confused. Like, well, gee, the government is us, even though I'm not a politician and I don't have police power and I don't get a say in any of this. But still, the government is us. But, you know, what that really means is the government gets to do whatever they want because they get to define themselves as you. You know? Oh, we're just the people. We're only doing this because the democracy said so. Anyway, Ed Snowden's a hero. If you don't like it, the problem is you. Simple as that. Give me a break. Some say he's a traitor. So? Some nincompoops say that. That doesn't amount to much, does it? No. Some people who crawl around on their bellies all day disapprove of what Edward Snowden did. Yeah, big deal. Also, one time, I held my breath underwater for a minute and a half. So? What does that have to do with anything? All right. Enough. Enough. Flint Leverett's going to be on the show. He's a former State Department guy. He's a former CIA guy. He's a former National Security Council guy. I don't think he was high behind trees and slit their throats sort of a dude at the CIA. He was an analyst. The guy who gets the information from guys like that and analyzes it. Anyway, former National Security Council guy, he and his wife, now wife, Hillary Mann Leverett, both left the Bush administration in disgust over their botched, horrifying Iran policy, which has created so much trouble in the region, low these many years. But anyway, they are the co-authors of the book Going to Tehran, and he's a professor at Penn State of International Relations. He will be on the show today to talk about the Geneva talks. I'll go ahead and ruin the surprise for you. I read his blog entry at goingtotehran.com, and it said, pessimism. There's just so many things standing in the way of decency prevailing here, basically. Anyway. We'll try. We'll do what we can. All right, so now, I did tell Phil that I'm going to try to take calls in the last half hour of the show, which means I better really get cracking on the news that I want to cover before break times start creeping up on me here. All right, I'm going to try to keep this quick. Believe me, I have an entire lecture. But I'm going to try to keep this really quick. There's two things about Rand Paul I want to complain about. So he gave this speech about the persecution of Christians around the world, as though it is Western civilization that is on the defensive. You know, he gave it to the Values Voters Summit, whatever. As a Western civilization is on the defensive from the so-called Muslim world. And he literally goes through ticking off countries where Christians are in danger in the Middle East right now, or in Central Asia too. He names Pakistan, of course, some things there. Crimes against Christians and so forth. Oh, but no Iraq in the speech. no acknowledgement of the fact that it's America's wars. It's the Republicans' wars in the Middle East more than anything that have disrupted the lives of Christians. The Assyrian and Chaldean Christians of Iraq, their civilizations that were there for 2,000 years were wiped out by America's war there. And, you know, we see, he's right to point out that America's backing the rebels, which include jihadi bin Ladenite types in Syria, who, as we saw, I forgot the name of the town or how to pronounce it, but you know the story about the town just a few weeks back that they seized and ran out all the Christians and committed a bunch of war crimes against them. And anyway, so he goes pushing this whole theme that it's the war on Christianity. And that, I guess that's what this whole terror war is about and whatever. In other words, the 9/11 attack was not some desperate Hail Mary pass by powerless pirates, a small collection of stateless individuals, to try to lure us into doing their dirty work in regime changing all the secular and Shiite regimes in the region and destabilizing and radicalizing everybody and everything. No, it wasn't that. It was the cutting razor edge of the gigantic, Islamo-fascist caliphate of intolerance coming to convert your kid and whatever. Cut your head off and convert your children. And he didn't say all that exactly, but that's basically what he's pushing, is that ridiculous, paranoid right-wing theme. And then, at the end, he goes, and that's why maybe we should intervene over there a little bit less, because we tend to make these problems worse a little bit, somewhat. Yeah, well, talk about burying the lead there, pal. And then the same thing with Iran. Here he is in Foreign Policy Today on Iran, saying, oh, we should always do whatever it takes. All options are on the table for defending Israel. We should not only maintain all the sanctions that we have, we should strengthen them, he says. Just so at the end he can say, so, but we ought to negotiate with them. If they want to negotiate, it's good that Obama's negotiating with them, and if he can work out real assurances. He doesn't say they must cease all enrichment or any, you know, Netanyahu particular. He's basically well-wishing Obama. Go ahead and deal with him. I think it's a good idea, too. But at the same time, of course, arguing that, but don't lift any of the sanctions, which would, of course, have to be our end of the deal if we were to make a deal. It would be the lifting of the sanctions. He's saying, no, strengthen them. Put more sanctions on them. Oh, but you just don't understand, Scott. He has to say something evil for the first 17 paragraphs so that in the 18th paragraph, he can say, and that's why we ought to intervene a little bit less. Or, and that's why maybe we should negotiate with them. Now, how far is that going to get you? You know what? I guess it's possible that I just don't understand these super sophisticated politics, and somehow the neocon establishment and the old WASP establishment and the Western cowboy military-industrial complex establishment and all the bankers and all the power mongers in America, all the pharmaceutical lobbyists and everybody else, all the energy industries, they're all just going to rally around Rand Paul, I guess, as long as he says a lot of evil stuff before he squeaks in one good thing at the end. They probably won't notice. He's just got to please all these centers of power, and then they're going to let him be president, huh? And then one day, and then, like Alex Coburn said, mocking the liberals who believed in Obama in 2008 before the election, and their belief in the secret Obama that's really in there, who's going to reveal himself once he has total power and is going to show himself as the guy who agrees with me on all the things that I think are great and important. But yep, that's what's going to happen. And once he becomes the president, then it's going to be awesome. That's what they're tweeting me. That's what they're writing on my Facebook. You didn't see the part where he said something good in there. Yeah, he had to sell this entire bogus clash of civilizations between the West and Islam just so he can say, oh, so we should bomb him a little bit less, in the part where you didn't even get that far in the damn thing. And you know what? The guy, the very, very politically correct liberal in the Daily Beast had it absolutely right that if anyone else was saying this, and they were saying Jews, the Jews this, the Jews that, or the Christians this, or the Christians that, we would look on it and say, this is ridiculous. I mean, we might freak out and say, oh my God, this is hateful, let's bomb them. At least we would say, this is preposterous. How can you say the Jews this just because Netanyahu likes to slaughter children in the Gaza Strip? That's not the Jews, okay? That's Netanyahu and his government and its employees in the military. That's who. Individuals. And even if you wanted to be a collective about it, it's Israel. It still ain't the Jews. Not by a long shot. Any more than the U.S. government slaughtering hundreds of thousands of people in Iraq amounts to a Christian war against Islam. Which is, of course, as the headline writer at the Daily Beast put it, exactly what Osama bin Laden had been trying to sell and what Ayman al-Zawahiri is still trying to sell the Sunni Muslim, particularly Sunni Arab world. Is that every time you see the United States and or Israel do a thing to somebody, that's their Christian Zionist crusader war against all of Islam. You see how they prop up their regime in Morocco? You see how they overthrew Saddam Hussein and killed all those people? You see how they put their bases next to Mecca Medina? You see how they hold a gun to the head of the Qatari princes to set the price of oil the way the Saudis want it? Or whatever it is. It's all a war against Islam by the Crusaders. That's what they're doing. Isn't that what you thought when you let your son, or encouraged even your son, to go join up the army? That he was a newfangled Crusader off to save the world, the Christian world, by killing off all the Islams? I mean, I guess it could be what a very small percentage of people thought. But no, what Americans thought when they joined up was, we're fighting back for the September 11th thing. They, whoever they are this week, attacked us. So, we're just doing something about it. What does that have to do with the Crusades? Nothing. In the minds of Americans, nothing. But that's what bin Laden said about us. And that's what rang true in a lot of ears. In Iraq, for example, when all around is death and destruction at the hands of predominantly white Christians in their Arab Muslim land. But Rand Paul goes, oh no, look, six Christians went to jail for converting or for blasphemy or something in a few places around. And then he even invokes the Boston attack. And he goes, he even says in his own speech, plays his own devil's advocate, how can you say the Boston attack on the marathon was the war against Christianity? Well, they didn't attack a mosque. Huh? They didn't attack a church or a synagogue either. They attacked the Boston Marathon. They killed a Chinese girl. What was her religion? Born again? What in the hell are you talking about? Well, you see, Scott, he just has to be evil. He just has to give in to the ignorance and hate and prejudice of the rank and file conservatives of America, so that he can try to sell them on peace and non-interventionism. It's a brilliant strategy. Yes, you're right to hate and fear and not try to understand the people who you imagine are your enemies. Oh yeah, it's terrible. But that's why we ought to leave them alone. And of course, what's his argument? We got to stop paying Egypt where they hate us. We're paying Egypt to not hate us. We're paying Egypt to not hate Israel. Like he doesn't know that. Bah, humbug. I want Ron back. Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send him a message at commoditydiscs.com or check him out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing, it's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire, the permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. See, my theory is that they're never going to let, they being people with power in America, they're never going to let Rand Paul be the president. They'll never even let him be the nominee. I don't think. Not by a long shot. So, it's all a bunch of selling out for nothing. The reason people loved his father, and the reason people hated his father, is because his father's good on things. His father speaks the truth. Not with a forked tongue. How much of a warmonger can I be without alienating all of my father's supporters? How much of a peacemonger can I be without alienating the Israel lobby and the military-industrial complex? How much of a free market guy can I be without alienating the energy industry and the pharmaceutical companies? Gotta balance. Gotta balance if you want that power. Gotta figure out just the right calculus. Bah, humbug. Give me 434 to nothing, man. Those were the good, or four, yeah, see, I screwed up my awesome thing. Give me 434 to one. Those were the good old days. Already so soon. All right, anyway, so I hate John Kerry. Here I've been saying that a chemical weapons deal is an implicit no regime change deal. And I'm not saying I'm pro-Assad, I'm not, but I am pro-America not regime-changing Assad. And so here's Kerry, and I, you know what, you could go ahead and speculate, if you'd like, that maybe he's trying to disrupt the chemical deal and prevent this thing from working so well, which apparently we've had nothing but optimistic signals out of Syria that, wow, this is going to go even easier than we thought. From the inspectors and the scientists and the destructors of the stuff. And anyway, Kerry is saying, nope, we got to push Assad out as soon as possible. So I don't know whether he really means to overthrow the entire government of just Assad. But I just wish he'd pipe down, that's all. They got a nice chemical weapons deal going. There's going to be a regime change. Let it be at the hands of somebody else. And call off the Saudis, too. I mean, the Saudis count as Americans. The Americans can call off the Saudis. They're participating. They're partners in this regime change. All right, anyway. Iran talks, we're going to talk about that. Sheldon Richman had a cool thing at FFF, which I haven't seen yet. But I guarantee you it's cool. And it's about the Articles of Confederation versus the Constitution. And I can't wait to watch it. It's a video. It's a two-part thing. It's basically the rerun. He does a live seminar once a month at FFF. Sheldon Richman, vice president there. And, anyway, this was one from a couple of months ago, I do believe. And, so the Articles of Confederation, I remember reading it, it's been a long time, but I remember thinking, I like this better than the Constitution. It ain't anarcho-capitalism, but it's better than what we've got now, by far. And you know what? They said that, well, you know, you had to have free trade between the states. You had to have a uniform currency of some kind. And so you had to have a new constitution. But the constitution is not a free trade agreement. It's a whole new national government. Seems to me like you could have the Articles of Confederation plus a free trade agreement. And if you need a universal currency, use silver. And or gold. And or whatever else the market determines. Ban the governments from creating paper money. You don't need a new national government for that. Hell, if 3/4 of the states can ratify a new constitution, they can ratify a no more printing money thing. Anyway. Good old Sheldon Richmond, man. He's good on everything. Check that out at fff.org. That's a Future Freedom Foundation. The Future Freedom Foundation. All right, then Muqtada al-Sadr is coming out denouncing Nouri al-Maliki for blowing it and all the terrorist attacks and whatever. And I didn't get a chance to read the whole thing, unfortunately, but it's just interesting to note that he's not so quietist these days. And Maliki really is only serving at his pleasure. He could withdraw support for the government at any time. I don't know if they have the constitutional power to just simply vote no confidence, but, you know, or call new elections. But certainly at the next election, Sadr could have Maliki replaced. Maliki's only power comes from the fact that he already has power. But people believe in Muqtada al-Sadr. He's the son and son-in-law of famous, credible martyrs. And help lead the Shiite majority to their conquering of Baghdad during the days of the recent American war. So he's got some street credibility still. Scary dude, by the way. You know, he'll arrest your daughter for smiling at somebody. Kind of a guy. Real medieval guy. America put him in power there. In concert with the Iranians. The Islamic Republic of Iraq, they call it now. There's so many different things on my list. Oh, Arafat. Go to Wired to read about Arafat. There's a new study that says he may have been poisoned with polonium by the Israelis. But then again, polonium has a very short half-life. And it's already decayed, and what they found was byproducts that could have come from polonium, but they could have also come from tobacco use, which apparently Arafat was a smoker. You know, cigarettes are radioactive. That's a real thing. Well, there's radioactivity in all the dirt, I guess in all your vegetables to some degree, but I don't know why it seems to be a thing with tobacco, but it is a thing. You look into it, that's all I know. All right, here's one that I want to talk about. Here's the most important thing in the whole world. The business cycle. What's that? That's the boom and the bust. You know, sometimes times are good. Everybody's making money. My buddy opened up a new thingamajig. And then other times, Jesus, everybody's broke. And as I was reading this morning, they're selling their kidneys. They're selling their eggs. They're shaving their heads and selling their hair. Just to try to keep the lights on. Let's get real. They're killing their children, their wives, and then themselves. That's what they're doing. They're losing their businesses. They're losing their property. They're losing their families. They're desperate. They're selling their kidneys. They're not giving up their kidney because they found Jesus in a near-death experience, and they are compelled to help a stranger. No, no, no. They have to feed their children. They're selling their kidneys. They're out of options. And how much can you even get for a kidney? A couple of months' rent for your freaking kidney? That's the boom and the bust. And the cause of it is the government's control over the supply of money. And anyone who tells you anything different is a liar and is trying to harm you. They dump a bunch of money into circulation. And that makes it seem like some investments are good investments when they're not. And in fact, it makes it seem like a lot of investments are good investments when they're not at the same time. But then reality comes due. It's just like you can hold a heavy weight up above your head for a long time. But eventually you're going to have to put it down. Yep. You can blow a bunch of hot air into a soap bubble in your sink. But eventually it's going to pop. You can try to prick it with a needle and let the air out slowly. Good luck with that. It's going to pop. And sorry to be so simplistic. How about if you give a junkie a bunch of meth, he'll feel really high, but then he'll crash and feel really bad. That's the business cycle theory. It's the truth. And I'm late for my break.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richmond, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richmond at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me you heard it here. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. We're on Liberty Express Radio, as well as No Agenda, Anomaly Radio, and my website, scotthorton.org, where you can find my interview archives, now more than 3,000 of them going back to 2003. And you can also follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /Scott Horton Show. And our first guest on the show today is the courageous whistleblower Colleen Rowley, formerly of the FBI and now civil liberties activist. Welcome back to the show, Colleen. How are you doing?
Great. That's amazing. You've been on since 2003.
Well, I can't find anything better to do than interview all you great journalists and activists. It seems like, everybody gets to hear from the bad guys all day long on TV, that kind of thing. I try to shine a light on people who really deserve it, and you certainly do, and that's actually what you've been up to as well. I'm only secondhand shining a light on somebody who deserves it this week. The subject, of course, being Edward Snowden, where you and some other whistleblowers and Ray McGovern all went to Moscow to give him the Sam Adams Award. So please tell us the story in as excruciating detail as you like. I'm all ears.
Sure. Yes, we have had the Sam Adams Associates for Integrity and Intelligence Group now for well over a decade, and have awarded a number of other whistleblowers. A lot, of course, early on, these were whistleblowers that spoke out about the Iraq War. And then there were people who spoke out about the faulty intelligence afterwards, like Larry Wilkerson, who had seen things close up. There were some awardees of the Sam Adams Award have actually been not whistleblowers, but were people who fought the good fight internally and were able to put out correct intelligence, such as Tom Finger, who put out the NIE in 2007 that revealed that Iran was not creating a nuclear weapon, and of course put a damper on President Bush's efforts to start the Iran war at that time.
Right, big
so
time.
So this group stems from The person it's named after, Sam Adams, was a CIA analyst, a colleague of Ray McGovern's, who knew that the enemy troop strength in Vietnam was twice the number as General Westmoreland and others would admit to, because they were trying to show progress. And they kept, you know, the message was that you're killing so many enemies, so then the number of enemy had to go down. Well, the CIA analyst, Sam Adams, found out that it was absolutely twice as many, over 500,000. And they refused to put, they just halved it arbitrarily. It's all in a book called The War of Numbers that Sam Adams kept notes and wrote right before, or he didn't write it, it was published after his death. And he went to an early death regretting that he had not spoken out sooner. Because the Vietnam Wall could have maybe been half the number of American casualties, and certainly the Vietnamese casualties would have been half the number as well, if he had told the truth, I mean, if he had gone to the press. And so this is very important for people to realize that speaking truth to power is a life and death matter in many cases, and Jess Radick was one of the Jess Radick and Tom Drake, the NSA whistleblower, were awarded this. I think it was 2009 or 10, where they got the award, and they went to Moscow and Ray McGovern and myself, and we were arranged this through Edward Snowden's human rights attorney, whose name is his last name is Kucharina. And we had to get visas. Of course, it's not that easy to travel to Russia, but it can be done. You fill out a long form. Our category was actually for a humanitarian award. And so we got to travel there, and we had a great opportunity to see him and speak with him and listen to him, reveal why he had done this, why he had sacrificed his career and basically his entire friends and life and everything in order to get this information out about how the NSA was spying on everyone, American citizens and citizens of other countries as well. And anyways, it went very well. His father actually came in the next day, and so Edward Snowden finally has, he's not completely alone, he's had a chance to meet with people now, finally.
Right. Okay, well, so I guess, I talked with Ray McGovern on the show about his role in this yesterday and some things that he had to say. But one thing I didn't really get a chance to ask him was if he would just tell us all about it. I think he mentioned you guys got to hang out with Ed Snowden for 5 hours or something. And I got about 2 minutes of audio of him speaking that I pirated from Amy Goodman here that I guess I'll play in the next segment. But so tell us about, you know, the time that you spent with him. I try to do as best I can on the show to cover the ins and outs of the NSA mm-hmm. stuff. Trevor Tim is going to be on the show tomorrow. Had Rachel something from the Brennan Center yesterday. But I want to know all about this Snowden guy because he's an American hero, and he doesn't get quite as much credit as American hero as he should because he hasn't been persecuted the way Bradley Manning was. And well, so people really felt bad for Manning. They're like, wow, look at how hard they're cracking down on him. Where Snowden was exiled, not to Siberia, but to the Moscow suburbs, and that probably ain't too bad, right? And so he's not getting quite the praise that I think he deserves. I think he's given up a lot so that mm-hmm. we can have this information.
And in fact, he learned from these other examples. He saw what happened to Manning. He saw what happened to Thomas Drake, who tried through internal channels, including inspector generals, including the 9/11 Commission and the Joint Intelligence Committee. Tom Drake had gone to all of those internal channels initially and still was prosecuted and was facing 35 years. So Edward Snowden actually was able to see this and realize that if you knew about these terrible illegal goings-on and counterproductive, I should say, at the same time, that actually endanger us far worse than what they're even doing, you know, in terms of fraud and waste as well. And so he knew that he would have to do this in a smart, intelligent way. The one thing I was kind of struck by that I don't think a lot of people know because the press has painted this very, they've tried to misinform the public, is the press kind of says that, well, he was a low-level contractor that somehow maybe surreptitiously gained access to these documents. And that, it turns out to be completely false. He was actually operating at a level where he could see the big picture. He wasn't compartmentalized as many, like an analyst would be, where they're really focused on a narrow area. And so if abuses are happening in the broader spheres or in another sphere, they won't even know about it. Snowden was operating at levels where he was even part of creating instituting some of these programs. And so handling the programs afterwards. So he was at a level, you know, it would be kind of the rare person, especially now, because I think they're going back to compartmentalizing more as a way of preventing sharing of information, and they're so afraid of leaking that they're actually going back against what the 9/11 Commission said, and they are doing more of this need-to-know compartmentalizing and scaring people if they happen to access something that is not within their purview. So he was in this situation where he really saw the big picture, and that is once he saw the picture and appreciated what was going on, he realized he had to do something to try to get a reform going. We, of course, carried the news that the debate has begun, and so that he should, in a sense, take some heart from the fact that his sacrifice hasn't been for nothing, that the Senate Judiciary Committee and the intelligence committees are beginning to look at, you know, proposals for bills to fix the problems that he has brought forth. And we discussed that a little bit. Snowden himself says, you know, that, you know, he won't rest until the Patriot Act and the FISA Amendment Acts are repealed. And, of course, that's, you know, probably pie in the sky in terms of hoping for a complete repeal. But the provisions are pretty vast. The Patriot Act has 264 provisions, and a lot of them aren't even related to this massive dragnet spying. So, but I know what he meant was that he wants these really problematic tools that the government has appropriated for itself illegally, you know, under reinterpreting words, etc. He wants that fixed, and so we kind of promised in a way that not only would we that he was giving this award for his own integrity, but that we would now try to, you know, help in that process of seeking reform. The first thing I did, and even about the same time as we were going, is I went to the Senate Judiciary hearing on October 2nd. And this was Clapper. This is a hearing that featured Clapper and Alexander testifying first as factual witnesses. Leahy kind of announced at the outset of the hearing that he wanted to get reforms and remedies to some of the abuses of the FISA and whatever. And then Clapper and Alexander were not put under oath. They asked them questions, and they were never sworn to tell the truth. And this contrasted with the fact that the second part of that hearing, they had two law professors and a professor about technology. And those professors, who are not fact witnesses, had to raise their right hand and swear to tell the truth. I mean, this was the oddest thing in the world, to see the Senate Judiciary Committee not swearing in Clapper and Alexander, who have track records for lying to them.
Yeah, I thought had to be Karl Rove to get treatment like that.
Yeah, and then forcing the law professors, who, frankly, it would make no sense to have them swear to tell the truth because they're just giving their opinions on what the state of the law is. I mean, this literally was a atrocious procedure. But besides that, they did get out a couple of key pieces of info. Keith Alexander was forced to admit that there has only been one or two examples that have shown the NSA's massive data collection helpful or beneficial in a terrorism matter that affected the United States. And, of course, this contradicted what he said a couple of months ago, where he claimed there were 54 examples. And so anyways, that kind of misinfo, which obviously is still continuing. Dianne Feinstein, in the hearing, she gets a chance to go ahead of the other people, and so she interjects this passionate speech about if the NSA had only been engaged in collecting such voluminous amounts of data, it could have possibly prevented 9/11. And if we change these programs or constrain these programs, then we risk another 9/11. That's what she said on October 2nd. Mm-hmm. And since that time, she's posted an op-ed on the Wall Street Journal, which is something like, the NSA programs protect Americans or something from another 9/11. So there we go. And in that, the Wall Street op-ed that was out yesterday or so by Dianne Feinstein, where she is pushing back against any reform, and in fact, her bill expands the surveillance of the NSA. It not only is pushing back against any reform, but it's actually expanding for further surveillance on a U.S. soil. In her op-ed, she goes back to the 54 examples, and she doesn't say in there that those have been debunked. It just says there are 54 examples. She goes back to the first Keith Alexander speech. I mean, there's a perfect example of, you know, people have to stay on this because this misinformation is just so incredibly whatever.
Right.
It just continues. They just don't. The truth doesn't seem to matter to these people.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, it seems like it's almost like Goebbels or something. Just keep lying. Keep telling so many lies that they can't keep up with them all. You know.
Yep. And you know, I could see in the hearing, other senators kind of shaking in agreement with her, especially, of course, Lindsey Graham, who was even worse. When he got his turn, he was even worse. But when she was saying this, of course, most of the heads on the Senate Judiciary were kind of shaked, nodding in agreement.
You know, people shouldn't understand, too, that, well, some people do, that the NSA, just like the FBI, the CIA, and any other agency that was supposed to be on the job that week or whatever, all fell down on the job of stopping the 9/11 attack with all the powers that they already had. And,
right.
You know, James Bamford points out in his book, The Shadow Factory, that the letters NSA don't appear in the 9/11 Commission report anywhere. And, of course, that's because they have major responsibility for that attack happening on their watch and their refusal to share what they had with the NSA or with the CIA and FBI both, just like the FBI and CIA had their own problems.
And Tom Drake was actually a witness to some of these intelligence inquiries, and I think on the 9/11 Commission, about the NSA's failures, but they were censored out. And the NSA was perfectly content to see the CIA and the FBI taking the heat for lack of sharing of information and not reading their own memos and et cetera. They were perfectly content because they were somehow able to keep all their dirty laundry information out of the report.
Right.
And Tom Drake, of course, you'll have to have him on sometime and ask him about this because he was one of the witnesses about it.
Yeah. Michael Scheuer, I'm sorry, just real quick, I'll say as fast as I can, but it's so important. Michael Scheuer, the former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, talked about trying to get the intercepts from the Yemen switchboard house, and the NSA wouldn't share them. So the CIA had to make their own listening station at Madagascar, but they could still only get half the conversation, the Yemen half of the conversation, not the Afghan half of the conversation, or anybody else. And the NSA and George Tenet, the way he said George Tenet would not go to the NSA and just make it happen. And so it didn't happen.
This is so important for these pieces of truth because they absolutely contradict what Dianne Feinstein is saying. In her op-ed and in her speech, she also made this point about how the CIA had been following some of the hijackers from a meeting in Malaysia. Well, in her writing, she never writes that the CIA did not tell the FBI that these two CIA terrorist suspects, they were actually on their list, had come into California. You won't even see that mentioned in her piece. And she makes it seem in her twisted version that if the NSA had its access to the vast amount of data that it now has, that it would have been able to stop the 9/11 attacks. And she actually is referencing the following of those two terrorists, but she's not explaining the half of it. I mean, it's pretty incredible. I've been tempted to call the, or to somehow contact the Wall Street Journal. It would be better probably if a Michael Scheuer or someone who actually was more firsthand could do that, could contact the Wall Street Journal and say, hey, you just published an op-ed that really is not factually correct. And can you please, at the very least, give somebody equal time to write the truth about this? Because she's trying to scare people by saying we're going to be subject to another attack. 9/11 wouldn't have happened if we'd done this. The very same way Hayden himself got the Senate, the Congress to roll over when they passed the FISA Amendments Act. I don't know if you remember how this. You probably do because you've been on this so long too. But it was August of 2007. Where Hayden went about midnight, you know, it was late at night, the Senate was about to recess, and he scared them into giving him temporary authority to continue the program that had been revealed by the New York Times as being illegal. Mm-hmm. And they all thought, of course, and he actually explicitly said, we'll have another 9/11 and the blood will be on your hands unless you give me this authority to continue what we were doing.
And that was the Protect America Act, right? Lasted until the spring when they did the FISA amendments.
That's right. It was a temporary one, and then it expired. And everyone thought, well, since it's temporary, once that temporary one was passed, it was just a no-brainer that the permanent one was going to pass.
Sure.
But he scared them a lot, and this tone is exactly the same way. And what will help is revealing that this metadata, vast collection of non-relevant info about innocent people, is just causing more problems for the analysts and for the people that are trying then to home in on somebody like Sarnoff Brothers, where they actually get tips, or Abdulmutallab, whose father actually calls the State Department, or Major Hassan, who had 8 or 9 emails that were in exchange with Alaki that they claim, I don't know if they said they didn't read them or what, but these were actually things that they say they're supposed to be focused on, and then afterwards claim they never read.
Well, pardon me for interrupting you here, but just for people who are just tuning in, this is not disembodied female critic voice talking. This is Colleen Rowley from the Minneapolis office of the FBI, and her team even speculated that, you know what, one of your FBI agents said, in a memo, I believe one, correct me if I'm wrong, that even went to headquarters speculating that I think this Moussaoui guy might want to learn how to pilot a plane so that he can crash into the World Trade Center. Now, a computer doesn't have intuition like that, but an FBI agent sitting there scratching his head and puzzling over what this Moussaoui guy is up to does.
That's right.
And, of course, he was told, you know, go ticket somebody for jaywalking or something else important like that. Go kick in a door on a pot warrant.
There were 60 to 70 communications exchanged between the Minnesota office and headquarters. The one you're citing about, this could be a guy who could fly into the World Trade Center, that was actually in a telephone conversation. But a lot of this was in written documents, even a draft declaration. A draft declaration speaking of FISA, and it was very detailed information. You pointed to something, which is that it takes humans to read, to carefully read, to assess, and then to either act up, to share information if they think it's important, or to act upon information. And all of that is missing before 9/11. Numerous examples of important memos that later the officials claim they never read, and even including in the FBI one that said Osama bin Laden is going to attack, and he's heavily entwined with the Chechen Ibn Khattab, and that Ibn Khattab tied directly to our case in Minnesota. And so that memo, which went to the director of the FBI and 8 assistant directors, who claim, this was in April of 2001, 5 months before 9/11. And then those officials, at least some of them, key ones, claim they never read the memo. I can tell you all kinds of instances where information, important information, was not even read. Then the other problem is the one that Tenet, you know, was asked, why didn't you do anything when you got the PowerPoint information, I think it was entitled Fundamental Islamic Islamist learns to fly. That was it. Islamist learns to fly. Fundamentalist. So fundamentalist learns to fly. And that was about the case in Minnesota. He got that information on August 23rd, 2001, about 3 weeks before 9/11. Well, he's asked afterwards, why didn't you share that information, or did you share it with anyone? Did you act on it? And he shrugs. He can't explain. He did nothing with it. He got briefed, but he never did anything with it.
You know what? I got to ask you, Colleen. You know, I can see that guy just being nothing but a big pile of shrugs in a way. And just, as Schroyer put it, lacking the moral courage to do his damn job, basically. But here's the thing about it, though, is have you seen, and I'm very anti-truther, actually, because I resent all the nonsense. But my very favorite truthers would be these guys that did the Richard Blee podcast 1 and 2. And they're basically, it's the sequel to Press for Truth, which my wife, Larissa Alexandrovna, was involved in the production of, and which I think is the best movie out of all of them. But then they did this Rich Blee podcast 1 and 2, which are the sequels. One's video, one's audio. And they contain Richard Clark, the White House head of counterterrorism, saying, oh, man, you know what? Now that you bring me this information and that information, Tenet lied to me on a daily basis about what he knew about Al-Qaeda in America. And here's the proof that he knew and what he did not tell me. And Richard Clark, pretty upset. It obviously didn't get much coverage because it's buried in a swamp of nonsense about Building 7 and whatever. But so I wonder if you have a comment about that. What do you make of that? I try to ask the questions as generally as I can, you know?
Yeah, I think there are just a ton of questions for George Tenet personally. And when he wrote his book and got a $4 million advance book deal for his version of history, and by the way, without having to go through any pre-publication review, which just shows you that the pre-publication review that everyone else has to go through is more or less just a fake thing to keep people from writing. Because he didn't go through any of this. He got $4 million for writing his book. And he was never asked, nor did he answer any of the questions. You're right. He absolutely just kind of shrugged. And the reason is, another big question along with this is, why did he not tell the FBI, or why did not the CIA advise the FBI of these two major terrorists that had come into California that they had been tracking? And they don't tell the FBI until just a couple of weeks before 9/11, because they could have been easily found. They were traveling under their true names. That's never been answered. Those have never been answered. And I don't think Tenet is the only one. I think, as we're talking, this NSA has probably, it's Keith Alexander himself, who knows. But some of these officials, when the truth will eventually come out, although we're still waiting, sitting on our hands and waiting for some of this, we're going to see probably that many other officials, of course, Tenet being a main one, but there were many who knew a lot and either did not share it, did not read it, did not share it, or certainly did not have the courage to act upon it. Now, what was their excuse? Remember, this is the important thing. Rumsfeld, I think, said this. I think even FBI Director Free, but this was this common refrain that intelligence is pouring in so fast that it's like a fire hose, and you can't get a sip from a fire hose. So they were trying to make this, flowery metaphor that we had so much intelligence that we couldn't connect the dots because we couldn't appreciate it. Well, if they wanted to use that excuse for then, they can't possibly, it does not at all jibe with what they're doing now, which was turning this fire hose into Niagara Falls.
Right.
I mean, the amount of information being collected pre-9/11 is nothing compared to what happened afterwards.
Well, they just need better Israeli software to run all the computer systems, that's all. And we need more whistleblowers, Colleen. That's the thing of it. More whistleblowers. I'm sorry, we're out of time. That's what the music means. Colleen Rowley, thank you very much for your time on the show.
Thank you.
Great to talk to you again. That's the great Colleen Rowley. She writes at the Huffington Post and a lot of other places. She just got back from Rush, where she was hanging out with Edward Snowden, giving him the Sam Adams Award for whistleblowing. And we'll be right back with Flint Leverett, formerly of the CIA, right after this.
Hi, I'm Brad Newman. I'm the creator of MyHeroesThink.com. Are you a fan of Ron Paul, Harry Brown, Murray Rothbard, Ludwig von Mises? Me too. These guys are my intellectual heroes, and because I can, I've decided to create my own monuments to them. So I'm bringing back the head bust. Visit MyHeroesThink.com and check out my artwork. Maybe you still have 5 empty inches on your bookshelf, or some space next to your computer. Maybe you'd enjoy having a statue of the libertarian who inspired you to think. Maybe you know a young person who just found these ideas, and you'd like to inspire them with a gift. I really can't think of people with more integrity to look up to. Visit MyHeroesThink.com and sign up for the mailing list. Be the first to know when my Hayek and Hazlitt statues become available. Most importantly, be sure to type Scott Horton into the promo line so we can help support this show, because I'm sick of bombing people. Visit MyHeroesThink.com.
Hey, all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else is stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. We're at Liberty Express Radio, No Agenda Radio, ScottHorton.org, Anomaly Radio, and everything radio. And you can find my full interview archive, more than 3,000 interviews now, going back to 2003 at ScottHorton.org. Next up is Flint Leverett. He's formerly of the CIA, the State Department, and the National Security Council. Now he is a professor of international affairs at Penn State and is co-author with his wife, Hillary Mann Leverett, of Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Welcome back to the show. Flint, how are you doing?
Very good, Scott. Good to be back with you.
Good times. Happy to have you here. You just got back from Iran, correct? Going to Tehran and everything, huh?
That's right. We were basically there the first week of October.
So how'd it go? Did you make a nuclear deal?
You know, I think there really is a nuclear deal to be made. I think that both President Rouhani and his new foreign minister, Javad Zarif, are being very proactive about that. We've had a number of conversations with Iranian officials, and I think, you know, they're outlining their approach to a deal in Geneva today and tomorrow. And it's very, very straightforward. Iran is prepared to do any number of things proactively to address any concerns that the United States or anyone else in the international community might have, that the Iranian nuclear program is somehow meant to give Iran nuclear weapons. You know, at the end of the day, they will abide by, they will ratify and implement the additional protocol, accept more intrusive verification and notification instruments with the IAEA. I think they might be prepared to put some limits on the scope of their uranium enrichment activity. But, you know, they're going to increase transparency, but in return, they are going to want their nuclear rights recognized. They have a right as a sovereign state. They have a right as a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty to enrich uranium for peaceful purposes under international safeguards. And they are going to want the United States and its British and French partners to recognize that legal, political, and physical reality, and they're going to want this issue resolved, and they're going to want sanctions lifted as part of the resolution. That is the straightforward way of doing this, greater transparency in exchange for recognition of Iran's rights. That's the deal that could be had today.
Well, and they're already saying how much, what percentage of that is already their position going into this thing?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just outlining their
position. Yeah, this is what they already said.
Yeah, and I think that at Geneva today, I think that Dr. Zarif and his colleagues are outlining, here are the things Iran is prepared to do to
that's
make
funny.
Sure
you know,
that...
Flint, honestly, at first, I was pretty sure that's what you're doing. You were just summing up what they said, but then you went on and on and on like that, and I thought maybe I kind of missed it, and what you were saying was, here are the outlines of the deal that one could imagine or something, and that I had misunderstood you. But no, really, that's as much as the Iranians have said already, the additional protocol and all the rest of it.
I think that's right. I think that's basically the outline of the package that Zarif and his colleagues have put on the table at Geneva today.
Yep. And which, by the way, not that it's that big of a deal or anything, but is exactly the outlines of the deal that we've been talking about, is the obvious outlines of the deal on this show for years and years now, and of course in your writings and everywhere else. It's the
that's
deal
right.
that everybody knows.
Yeah, that's one of the strengths of the Iranian proposal. It actually is congruent with reality.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's what, well, let's see. You know, we know Netanyahu's going to have a fit if you keep going up to 20%. So how about you just keep it at 3.6 and we'll, you know, additional protocol so that we can inspect some non-nuclear facilities like where you make the centrifuges, because that'll make somebody happy. These
yeah,
kinds of things,
and inspect
right?
more proactively. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's funny to hear, you know, in the TV news media, the way they sum these things up all the time, you would think that they have some secret facilities that have never been seen by the IAEA before that perhaps, I'm paraphrasing CNN International from this morning, that, you know, perhaps now we'll finally have access to these. But they don't have anything like that, do they?
No. You know, it's been kind of a fantasy of Israeli intelligence, some Western intelligence agencies, for years that there's like this parallel program somewhere, that there are these publicly declared facilities that the IAEA inspects, monitors, has cameras in 24/7, all of this stuff. But then somewhere, you know, there's this whole other infrastructure that, you know, no one other than, you know, a handful of Iranians know about, and this is where Iran's really working on the bomb. It's just, you know, for no lack of effort on the part of these intelligence agencies, there's not one single shred of actual evidence that anyone's been able to put forward that this parallel infrastructure exists. It's just you know, I think basically a fantasy.
But everything that we do know they have, Natanz and Fordo and Isfahan, however you say that, and the
yeah.
Iraq heavy water reactor, all of this infrastructure, every bit of it is regularly inspected and safeguarded by the International Atomic Energy Agency already.
Absolutely, all of it is regularly inspected. There are some non-nuclear facilities which the IAEA does not normally have the authorization to inspect. The facility that some people get exercised about now is a military facility called Parchin. And, you know, the IAEA says it wants to come into Parchin and inspect it because they, you know, some intelligence agency, probably the Israelis, have told the IAEA that this is where the Iranians are working on, you know, the high explosives you need configured in a certain way in a nuclear bomb to crush the core of fissile material, start the chain reaction that leads to a nuclear explosion. And the Iranian position on that, and you see lots of press reports, the Iranians refuse to let the IAEA come to Parchin. And, you know, the Iranian response says, first of all, the IAEA has no right to come to Parchin. It's not a nuclear facility. It's part of our safeguards agreement. Secondly, we've already let the IAEA into Parchin twice. And each time, and you know, it was done on a basis where, and Parchin's a huge facility. And until the IAEA inspectors arrived, the Iranians didn't have any idea where the inspectors wanted to go. So the idea that they could somehow, you know, clean up something so the IAEA couldn't find it is pretty fanciful. They've let the IAEA do this twice, and each time the IAEA came back and said they found absolutely no evidence that anything nuclear-related was going on at Parchin. But now, you know, the Israelis or somebody had, you know, kind of said, oh, no, now this time we really do have evidence that they're doing it. And so the IAEA has come back and said, we want to go to Parchin again. And the Iranians are saying, if we're going to let you come to Parchin again, you know, we want to get have this issue closed. We want, you know, basically, we want it kind of certified, sealed, that Parchin's not a nuclear facility, and, you know, you guys aren't just going to keep coming back and saying every 6 months, you know, something's going on at Parchin. We have to inspect it. We have to have some kind of closure on this. And, you know, that's the current dispute. But this is over a facility that the IAEA has already visited twice and said both times there's no evidence of any nuclear-related activity.
And now, are you saying that Parchin is on the table of discussions right now in Geneva?
I doubt if it's on the table in Geneva. I suspect that that's going to be something where that's something the Iranians wouldn't negotiate with the P5 plus one directly. That's something that they would work out with the IAEA. Uh-huh. And then if, you know, they worked out something satisfactory with the IAEA, the IAEA would tell the P5 plus one, you know, this is being taken care of.
Right.
But I doubt it's, I mean, you know, the nature of the inspections and so forth is very technical. And, I think it would probably be something that actually ends up getting resolved between Iran and the IAEA.
All right. So now I'd like for you to help explain to me this discrepancy here between what all powers would, at least typically, I guess they could customize it in any given case, but what all powers would typically be granted to the IAEA above and beyond the safeguards agreement if they sign the additional protocol compared to the powers granted to the IAEA, and I guess that's a granted in quotation marks, by the UN Security Council, which has mandated that the UN or that the IAEA inspect all these other non-nuclear facilities and ask all these endless questions based on the alleged studies and all these other mandates to the IAEA that are separate from what's already in the safeguards agreement. And then I guess secondarily to that, is it legal at all for the UN Security Council to mandate all that extra stuff when the UN Security Council are all members of the NPT and are already sworn to respect Iran's right to peaceful nuclear technology in the first
place? That's a really, really good point. You know, you could make an argument that the Security Council is essentially entitled or empowered to you know, to do whatever it wants, to do whatever it can get the five permanent members to agree to. But I think if you actually look at the UN Charter, you know, the UN Charter empowers the Security Council to act to deal with threats to international peace and security, up to and including authorizing the use of military force to deal with those threats. But it says that the Council has to act in accordance with, you know, the principles of the UN Charter. And the principles include respect for national sovereignty, respect for international law, respect for treaty obligations and commitments that states undertake, you know, aside from the Charter. And I think you're exactly right. There's a very powerful argument that could be made that by, you know, essentially requiring the Iranians to give up or to suspend a right, namely the right to enrich uranium under safeguards, which it has both as a sovereign state and as a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, that the Security Council itself is acting in an, you know, extra legal or, you know, could almost say unconstitutional way. And that is the Iranian position, that those parts of the Security Council resolutions saying that Iran has to suspend its enrichment activities, that those are actually illegal. They are inconsistent with the Charter, and therefore they're not binding. Now, of course, as I said, there is a school of thought that says basically whatever the Security Council says, you have to do. But I think there is a powerful argument the other way.
Well, all you have to do is the golden rule thing. If somehow we lost our veto for a week and they said the United States has to do this, that, and the other thing, the United States would say, yeah, you and what army?
Yeah. Yeah. That's true, too. I think in terms of the additional protocol, I think that what the additional protocol would let the IAEA do beyond the standard safeguards agreement is it first of all lets IAE inspectors come and inspect facilities on a much, you know, basically a kind of snap or surprise basis. Much more feasible for them under the additional protocol, you know, simply to come and say, all right, we're here, we want to inspect this facility, we want to inspect it now, and they have an authorization to, and they have a legal basis for doing that. In the standard safeguards agreement, it's a little more, you know, sort of procedural. The IAEA comes at regular intervals. If it wants to do something outside of the kind of regularly scheduled stuff, it has to request it well in advance, all of this. This would basically allow the IAEA to inspect much more, I guess you could say, in a way, much more aggressively. It also gives them more of a basis for coming in and saying, you know, aside from your declared nuclear facilities, we think we have some concerns about other facilities, and we want to be able to go there in order to make sure there's no undeclared nuclear activity or make sure that there's no other, you know, activity of concern there. And the advance notice for doing that is shorter than it would be under the Comprehensive Safeguards Agreement. So, you know, it just lets the IAEA be more proactive and be more kind of assertive, operate on much shorter time frames for some of their inspections activity.
Assuming this all works, which I hope it does, not that I even see any controversy over Iran's nuclear program, but whatever. Put the pretended controversy to bed if you can. But then now this is a giant arrow in the quiver of the war party, or at least the sanctions party, that look how well this worked, that all we had to do was deprive their hemophiliac children and their old ladies with cancer of the medicine that they need to stay alive, and they had to give in all our demands. Why, we could put sanctions on all kinds of countries that we hadn't thought of yet.
Yeah, well, the sanctions bit is a really two-edged sword. And I think, you know, the war party, as you I think quite appropriately put it, you know, the people who want tighter and tighter sanctions, you know, who want children not able to get medicine that they need, you know, they will not be pleased if Obama were to make a deal more or less along the lines we've been talking about. You know, their view is that Iran should have no right to enrich, should have no centrifuges operating inside Iran, and that's what would amount to victory. So, you know, I think there, if Obama were to cut this deal, I think that you know, the war party would be more disappointed than happy. But the sanctions,
Sorry, I got to interrupt you there, Flint. Hold it right there. We got to take this short break, and okay. Then when we come back, we'll talk more about the politics, domestic politics of this Iran deal here and the sanctions. It's Flint Leverett from Penn State. We'll be right back. Going to Tehran.com. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Oh man, I'm late. Sure hope I can make my flight.
Stand there.
Me? I am standing here.
Come here.
Okay.
Hands up, turn around.
Whoa, easy.
Into the scanner.
Ooh, what's this in your pants?
Hey, slow down. It's just my...
Hold it right there. Your wallet has tripped the metal detector. What's this? The bill of rights?
That's right. It's just a harmless stainless steel business card-sized copy of the Bill of Rights from SecurityEdition.com. They're for exposing the TSA as a bunch of liberty-destroying goons who've never protected anyone from anything. Sir, now give me back my wallet and get out of my way. Got a plane to catch.
Have a nice day.
play a leading role in the Security Theater with the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's the size of a business card, so it fits right in your wallet, and it's guaranteed to trip the metal detectors wherever the police state goes. That's SecurityEdition.com. And don't forget their great Fourth Amendment socks.
Hey guys, I got his laptop.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. We're on the line with Flint Leverett from goingtotehran.com. It's also the title of the book he co-authored with his wife, Hillary Mann Leverett. And he teaches international relations at Penn State. And we're talking about the possibility of the nuclear deal. Today's the big day of the meeting in Geneva where looks like much better chance of a deal than, say, compared to October 2009, I think. But then, like you were saying just now, there's a pretty stiff constituency in the United States for never making peace with Iran, or at least never compromising whatsoever.
Yeah, that the only peace that would be acceptable for this camp is basically a peace based on Iranian surrender. And, you know, I don't think that's really in the cards.
Can they stop this from happening, Flint?
I think that for Obama to make the deal that he should make on this issue, he's going to have to spend political capital, you know, confronting and marginalizing those forces who basically don't think there should be any enrichment of uranium allowed in Iran. You know, he's going to have to deal with pro-Israel constituencies. He's going to have to deal with, you know, all of the constituencies that buy into an essentially neoconservative vision for American foreign policy. He's going to have to spend political capital to do that. And I hope I'm wrong, but I'm not particularly confident that he's going to be willing to spend that kind of political capital on this. I also want to say about sanctions. It's a really important question you raised. That you know, even if you look at it, most of the sanctions that the U.S. applies against Iran have at this point been written into law. Many of them started out over the years as what you'd call executive order sanctions. The president cites some general authorities that he has under U.S. law and issues executive orders that impose various types of sanctions on Iran. What the Congress has done, basically, while Obama has been president, and he has, in my view, very foolishly signed all of these bills, is they've taken these executive order sanctions, they've made them law, so that the president can't just unilaterally modify or take back an executive order. They've made them law, and they've spelled out conditions that Iran would have to meet before the sanctions can be lifted. And the sanctions, the conditions don't just deal with the nuclear issue. You know, under current law, Iran could do what Libya did back in 2002-2003, basically let the CIA and the Department of Energy come in, dismantle every centrifuge they've got, put them in crates, send them back to the nuclear lab in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. You know, Iran could do that, and under current U.S. law, the administration, President Obama, still could not lift sanctions on Iran because now the law says Iran has to, you know, give up ties to groups that the U.S. government considers terrorist organizations like Hezbollah. It has to reform its internal political order, basically turn itself into a sort of secular liberal republic of Iran. And, you know, I think this is going to be a real problem, even if the administration, you know, manages to get itself into a position where it wants to do the right thing in terms of the diplomacy. You know, they're not going to be able to offer on their own very much in terms of sanctions relief to Iran, not without getting some significant changes in U.S. law through Congress. And I think this could turn out to be a big problem.
Yeah, it sounds a lot like what happened to Iraq in the 1990s on the U.N. Security Council, where the sanctions were permanent. You'd have had to pass a new law to repeal them. instead of having to, you know, reauthorize them every once in a while or anything. So Bill Clinton didn't have a let it sunset type of a thing to, as, even as an option, not that that's what he wanted or anything. But
that's right. I mean, there was a case where you had both bad law and bad policy. I mean, the Clinton administration said even if Saddam complied with all of the relevant U.N. Security Council resolutions, the Clinton administration would not allow a lifting of U.N. sanctions until Saddam was removed from power.
Right.
But then, you know, you're right, because of U.S. law, at least after 1998, it would have been very difficult for Clinton to lift Iraq-related sanctions.
All right, now, you talked about political capital, and I don't know what difference it makes. Maybe I'm wasting time. I should be asking a better question. But doesn't it seem to you, Flint, that this is great politics? Making a peace deal, this is the best thing ever. And also defeating those loud-mouth, hateful Republicans that everybody already hates anyway, and saying the Republicans tried to stop me from making peace, but I made peace anyway. How could he possibly go wrong with that?
Well, I think because this is an issue where the Democrats in Congress don't really present very much of an alternative to the Republicans in Congress. Now, I know that there are people who could say with some reason that that's the case on, you know, sadly, too many issues. But this is a case where I think it's really true. You know, you look at the sanctions bills that have been passed by Congress. They're passed overwhelmingly by huge bipartisan majorities. You know, there are Democratic senators who are, you know, at least as enthusiastic proponents of Iran sanctions as what you would think of as the hardest line, you know, neoconservative Republican voices in the Senate. There isn't really a Democratic Party constituency of any real size.
But they can't fight him that hard on this, can they? I mean, he's
still there.
President, the Democrats in the Senate.
He is their president, but you know, I think that Obama has found out before on other issues, and this will be one where he ends up basically having to go against the Israeli government, go against the pro-Israel lobby here. The Israel lobby can make life very hard for Democratic congressmen, including Democratic congressmen who want to get reelected next year, and even if they want, if these congressmen want to support the president, it's going to make it very, very hard for them. It's going to reduce their willingness to cooperate with Obama, to take politically risky votes that Obama might ask them to take on various domestic issues. Their willingness to run those risks is going to be reduced if they're getting flack from the pro-Israel lobby over what the president's trying to do on Iran. And I don't really think Obama's going to get a lot of Democratic support for really significant change in U.S. policy toward Iran.
All right. Well, good luck to all of us. That's Flint Leverett, everybody. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Scott.
Flint Leverett writes at goingtotehran.com. That's also the name of the book. He teaches foreign policy at Penn State. We'll be right back with more news after this. ScottHorton.org. LibertyExpressRadio.com. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against a depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council of the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys. I'm Scott Horton. Welcome back to the show here. It's the Scott Horton Show. You know, I guess I never did hear from the people that did that thing. Yeah, well, there was this thing that they did, man. It was, you probably already saw it. It was about how, wow, so many of the people hogging the airwaves, pushing war against Syria, a limited campaign of airstrikes, are all tied directly to the military-industrial complex. People like Stephen Hadley, who used to be a lawyer for Lockheed, now is on the board of directors of Raytheon, or the board of something or other. Sales. He's the vice president for marketing. Or something like that there at Raytheon. And they published an op-ed by him in the Washington Post saying, you know, what we really need to do is shoot a bunch of Raytheon brand Tomahawk missiles at Syria. Subtle enough for you. Huh. It's almost like the economy is built on the corruption of the military-industrial complex. Huh. The permanent war economy. I wonder if that's the reason for the rivers of the blood of innocence caused by America's foreign policy. I wonder why the ocean's color seemed off. Oh, it was the military-industrial complex. Those rivers empty out into the ocean, you know. The sea. And by the way, if you think that any of that is hyperbole, you can't get hyperbole when it comes to the American Empire. Nothing that you can say is more ridiculous than the way it really is. I mean, and tragic, too. But, yeah, both. New Air Force cargo planes fly straight into mothballs. I'm sorry I didn't get to this the other day. It's from the 7th of October at Fox News, so maybe not one word of it is true. Who knows? I don't know. I guess I accept their claim in this case because it's against their bent to attack the military most of the time. And because I didn't hear anybody dispute it. And they do have a pretty picture of an airplane. Seemed plausible to me. New Air Force cargo planes fly straight into mothballs. The Pentagon is sending $50 million cargo planes. God almighty. $50 million cargo planes straight from the assembly line to mothballs because it has no use for them. Yet it still hasn't stopped ordering the aircraft. A dozen nearly new Italian-built C-27J Spartans have been shipped to an Air Force facility in Arizona dubbed the Boneyard. And five more currently under construction are likely headed for the same fate, according to an investigation by the Dayton Daily News. The Air Force has spent $567 million on 21 of the planes since 2007. Does that arithmetic check out? According to purchasing officials at Dayton's Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Of those, 16 have been delivered, with almost all sent directly to Davis-Monthan Air Force Base in Tucson, where some 4,400 aircraft and 13 aerospace vehicles with a total value of more than $35 billion sit unused. By all means, it's better than killing people with them. But holy moly, man. I mean, if this was a skit, you couldn't make it up, right? Remember, people got all outraged over the $50 toilet seat and the $75, $700 hammer and whatever it was. Almost $600 million. And this is just chump change, right? This is just nothing. This is just the remainder that turned up in a newspaper article somewhere. Almost $600 million buying planes that they throw directly into the trash. $600 million. See, that's the thing that really pisses me off about the wars. I don't make much money, never have. So the grand total of all the taxes I've ever paid, it ain't that much. But to think that all of it just went to pay for the tire on this plane that they threw in the trash that they never use, right? Every cent that they ever took right out of my check that, man, I could have spent on something else, it went to nothing, right? It went to the floor mat in front of the back seat of this $600 million boondoggle that went straight into the trash. They call this capitalism, but it seems to me more like it's just the U.S. federal government, Uber Alice. You know, it used to be a lie. It used to be a clever PR trick, a sleight of hand for the government to claim that it is the people, the country, the land. But then again, you know what? Maybe this is fascism, huh? Maybe even with a capital F. It is, as Robert Higgs says, well, it's a participatory fascism. You get to go down and choose your fascist ministers every once in a while. You know, I have a friend who, he really means well. He really does. He's a human rights guy, he thinks, mostly. Certainly not cruel. Certainly is not any sort of bigot against any race or class or religion of people of any kind. But he said, you know, I think I'm a fascist. I mean, not with the marching army thing and everything, but just, I think pretty much the executive branch of everything should just determine how everything is, because they're pretty good at determining the public goods and the whatever, whatever. People really believe that stuff. My counter argument is, really? Look at this. They spend $1 trillion a year on militarism. $1 trillion a year. And that's from the left-wing Mother Jones, if you're a left-winger. And that's from the, you could probably settle for them, Libertarian Independent Institute. If you're a libertarian, you love them. If you're a right-winger, you could settle for them, is what I was trying to say there. And also there's the public, Chris Hellman at the National Priorities Project. That's right. They're a nonpartisan study group thing. There's three good footnotes for you. $1 trillion a year they spend on militarism. That's fascism in practice. I'm only just starting the book, so I haven't interviewed him about it yet. I'm going to read the thing and then interview him. But I did see Max Blumenthal saying, yeah, Zionism is your idea is of it is this, and Zionism, your idea of it is that. But the reality of Zionism? Colonialism. So, yeah, about your imagination. This is how it really is. Well, geez, if America was a dictatorship, that'd be fine, so long as I'm the dictator, said George W. Bush, and said everybody else too, right? Pretty much. Especially if they really thought they had a shot at it. But this is what you get when you have, never even mind a completely nationalized economy. This is what you get when you have a mixed economy. A completely nationalized economy, y'all just starve. You can't even get a job making a plane to throw away. In a completely nationalized economy. But this is a mixed economy for you. Where we have to, you know, wipe the sweat from our brow. At least they're not using these cargo planes to transfer kidnapped innocents to their torture dungeons. Thank goodness. Because, you know, typically that's what they do with the cargo planes. Oh, and also ship weapons to people to use to kill people with. You know, when they're not torturing people, it's because they're busy killing people. Pissed away. And also, and this is what I was trying to get to before when I realized that I was talking straight into the commercial break, is the boom bust cycle. Why do you think that they only ever print money all day? It's so the wars seem free. That's what it is. It's so they don't have to raise your income tax rate when they invade a country. They tell you things like, oh, nah, the war's going to pay for itself. In fact, keep an eye on your mailbox. Don't just throw all your bills away like usual because you have a $300 special gift from the government from going along with this war. That's right, $300 rebate for everybody as they launch their war to try to make it seem like this is for you, that somehow you benefit. Yeah, they're killing a lot of Arab babies. Oh, the pain that they scream in as they die. It's horrible. But we get the oil, and we get good jobs, and we get a good economy, except that's all fake prosperity. That's simply your fever given to you by the Federal Reserve and their easy money policy. Well, geez, I bought a small piece of property, and its value just keeps going up and up and up and up, and I just keep refinancing it over and over and over again and keep cashing in all this money. Bought myself a new car, too. Everything's great. I'll never have to work again. For some reason, the prices of everything that I own just keep getting more and more and more valuable. It's oh, oops. $15 trillion worth of wealth got destroyed. That'll happen. Sometimes that'll happen. It was all a big fake illusion to bribe you into not objecting to the war. You know, the Iraq war in this case is the one I'm referring to mostly. But of course, the whole terror war, it's cost $8 trillion so far and change. There's a whole new homeland security state to parallel the foreign national security state we already had, and which already included the FBI, counterterrorism and counterintelligence divisions and whatever. The militaries, too. Their domestic forces, too. But now, you know, the Washington Post was, you know, did a giant study, top secret America, about, wow, hey, everybody, guess what we created? You think we had a military-industrial complex before? The only people making money now are working for the state, basically. And I guess guys who are, you know, video game programmers, they're cashing in the free market. But everybody else. And in fact, the government subsidizes a lot of the video game companies, right? To help make first-person shooters to train the next generation of military killers. So, you know, good times for everybody. It's the complex, right? That's what Nick Turse says. It's not the military-industrial complex. It's the military-industrial, congressional, video game, scientific, academic, toothpaste and tube socks and everything else complex. Everybody's on the military dole in America. Everybody. Just think of the contracts for Marlboro and Camel. You know? Just think of how much money Taco Bell and the rest of Yum Enterprises made putting little Taco Bells and Pizza Huts at American military bases all over the globe. The entire theater of the terror war over the last dozen years. It's no different than if there's a debate about drug or police policy in your state, you'll see the people with the most obvious conflict of interest will be the first in line to complain. Legalize weed? Oh, no, you don't, screams Anheuser-Busch at the top of their lungs. They don't even know they're supposed to be embarrassed. They don't even know that they ought to be bribing people in secret to do their bidding. They just scream, no, protect alcohol! Same difference. And anyway, so, yeah, what happened was Franklin Roosevelt ruined everything. He got America into World War II, and then the Pentagon never went away again. The generals and the admirals and all of their hardware and all of their blood spilling, it never stopped since. They've killed a Holocaust worth of people since then. You know, people say about Vietnam, somewhere between 3 and 5 million died. Somewhere between 3 and 5 million. That means in some places, they killed so many people that there was no one left alive who knew who had been alive before, who's now gone. There are people who everybody who knew of their entire existence, they all died too. Somewhere between 3 or 5 million. That's a hell of a remainder you got there. Gray area where you have to start guesstimating. Well, gee, do you count that the babies that we poisoned to death with the Agent Blue? Or do you count Laotians that you blew apart in a secret war that Congress never said you could? Sometimes it's hard when you're doing the math. 1 million Iraqis have died in the last 12 years. They're still dying in the war America created there. But anyway, so they haven't stopped since. And they've perverted the entire economy. You know, I can't remember which horrible warmonger I'm trying to denounce right now. It was somebody very blatant. Oh, this might be from The War State by Michael Swanson. Was it George Kennan? I think it was George Kennan who just said, in polite company where it was okay, who just said, the adjustment from the war economy as we've created it back to some kind of free market system would be too traumatic. We can't. We have to stay at war forever from now on. That's basically the thinking behind NSC 68. That's why it doesn't matter whether the report from Iron Mountain is a satire or not. The study on the desirability of peace. No, they decided that the adjustment would be too much. Now, I'm actually pretty optimistic about that. For all my complaining, I like people. And I tend to think that regular folks, they're not smart enough to run my life or yours, but they are okay at running their own and figuring out what they think they can do to do better. And I think that if I Dream of Jeannie was working for me, and I could abolish the entire national government and somehow create some force field that would prevent it from coming back into existence, and every one of these military employees and military contractors and homeland police state, tax parasites, if they all had to get real jobs, if we had sound money overnight, and no more boom and bust to trick the entire culture into making all the wrong decisions at the same time for 10 years straight at a time and then suffering the horrific consequences, etc. I think it would all adjust real quick. You know? Like splashing water around in your mug. Boy, it's pretty splashy. Yeah, but if you leave it alone, it'll settle. No problem. Not that everything will be perfect, not that everything will be utopia, but prices will find their level. And people who used to be engineers at DARPA will find ways to get people fed instead. If you can their ass. Go ahead, fire them. In fact, be a jerk about it. No severance, no nothing. You're fired. All of you. We're sure that you'll do great in the free market. Convincing people to voluntarily part with their hard-earned money so that you may provide a good or a service to them. You can do it. That is a trauma. That is an act of so-called creative destruction that I would wholeheartedly embrace. Abolish the entire state, particularly the military and national security states, and the entire perverted economy that's dependent on them. Abolish that entire system immediately, and everything will be fine in a week and a half. No more government-backed paper money, either. That's going to have to be a big part of the thing. It's the boom and the bust. It's the worst thing in the world. It's worse than war. Think of the suffering caused by the financial collapse of 2008 that we're still going through right now. Worldwide, think of the immeasurable, I don't know if it's killed as many people as the Iraq War, but it's pretty damned bad, man. It's a lot, it's in ways that it's hard to measure, You destroy $15 trillion worth of wealth on paper, however much real wealth that actually is that got diverted off and wasted that could have been used, productively. There's really no way to truly understand the opportunity costs. Some of that money could have been invested in things that would have changed the world forever. That you have no idea. So, you can guess that, geez, I wonder if instead of the government wasting $10 trillion and more killing people in the 21st century, what if that money just stayed in the pockets of free people to do with what they wanted? What if instead of a massive fake boom and a massive society-destroying bust, we just had slow and steady economic growth based on increased productivity and technology and workmanship and new immigrants and great things like that that help drive economies. It'd be like Back to the Future 2 with the flying cars and the rest of it. I'll tell you what. At least that's what I'm saying. All right. Well, anyway, lots of lecturing, not enough news covering. I'm sorry. But I like lecturing folk. I mean, assuming any of you guys like it. I think some of you do. You know what? I'm going to play this Snowden audio for you. Somebody asked Ed Snowden to say a thing in Russia the other day.
These programs don't make us more safe. They hurt our economy. They hurt our country. They limit our ability to speak and think and live and be creative, to have relationships, to associate freely. And they're going, this doesn't make us more safe, it makes us less safe. It puts us at risk of coming into conflict with our own government. And there's a far cry between legal programs, legitimate spying, legitimate law enforcement, where it's targeted, it's based on reasonable suspicion, individualized suspicion, and a warranted action, and sort of dragnet mass surveillance that puts entire populations under sort of an eye that sees everything, even when it's not needed. This is about a trend in the relationship between the governing and the governed in America that is coming increasingly into conflict with what we expect as a free and democratic people. If we can't understand the policies and programs of our government, we cannot grant our consent in regulating them. As someone very clever said recently, we don't have an oversight problem. We have an undersight problem. And it's led us to a point in our relationship with the government where we have an executive of the Department of Justice that's unwilling to prosecute high officials who lied to Congress and the country on camera, but they'll stop at nothing to persecute someone who told them the truth.
Ain't that the truth? Well, I'm glad he's safe in Russia. I think it's absolute disgrace that he had to go to Russia to be safe. But anyway, there you have it. I like Ed Snowden. He did the right thing. And you know, Greenwald says, yeah, he donated to Ron Paul, but he's not really that ideological of a guy. You can tell he's not a hardcore libertarian there, the way he used the term democracy. A libertarian would have said something more specific right there instead. So, but he did support Ron Paul because he liked what Ron Paul was saying about, like, hey, we don't want to give up the Bill of Rights forever, do we, guys? And it was clear, of course, that Ron Paul meant it when he said it. But anyway, so, I'll take it. I say he's a Ron Paulian of some description. And I will point you to Time Magazine where they're quoting Greenwald saying, oh no, we still haven't gotten to the good stuff yet. We're working on reporting it right now. I'll also point out to you that they've got James Risen, who's, you could say the best guy at the New York Times. And they've also got Bruce Schneier, who is an independent computer security expert and is a real expert. And he's now working, I believe, with The Guardian, with Greenwald, first and foremost, on this story. So that is great news. And in fact, I saw someone tweeted the name of someone else I'm not familiar with, but who also apparently is a real technology expert. and saying what a great thing it is that these two guys, and this guy and Schneier, were being brought in on reporting the story. Because just that means you can anticipate some top-notch journalism coming. The perfectly explained understanding of what this really says. And, you know, I don't know. The most explosive stuff is still coming. I'm sorry to infect your mind with paranoia, but it's got to be the webcams, right? I keep mine covered up, man. Ever since they started embedding them in the laptop. Oh, no. And I know that it's got a microphone I can't even see. It's got no switch. I don't even think it has a setting I can find. I'm afraid of my laptop. Anyway, more Snowden coming. Oh, by the way, there's new Snowden today. Gelman in the Post. They've got your buddy list and your entire email contact list. Oh, but you don't mind, right? They're just protecting you from Osama and all that. All right, see you tomorrow, guys.